on the right solid rocket booster. A gas leak at that point had been seen in footage just before the disaster. But Morton Thiokol, the company that manufactured the O-rings, insisted that their product couldn't have been the problem. In the course of the televised hearing, Feynman offered an experiment. He used a flexible O-ring of the same material, clamped in a C-clamp, and submerged in the ice water on the table in front of him. When he took the O-ring out and removed the C-clamp, it did not resume its previous shape. It wasn't resilient. For at least a few seconds, long enough to cause a major failure, the material cramped in the cold. In an appendix to the final Rogers Commission report, Feynman wrote, "For a successful technology, reality must take precedence over public relations, for nature cannot be fooled." Feynman's was a beautiful experiment. Beautiful first and foremost for its simplicity. Media was at a fever pitch. Within an hour, 85% of the American public had seen rebroadcasts or heard of the disaster. The reputation not only of major companies, but of NASA and the United States space program were at stake. What caused the crash? Look at what happened to that O-ring in a glass of ice water. In this lecture, I want to talk about the structure of experiments, putting questions to the test. Feynman's is just one of the beautiful experiments I want to explore. An understanding of scientific experimentation and of its limits is an important part of the contemporary philosopher's toolkit. An understanding of experimentation is important both in backing your own claims and in evaluating claims of others. In order to establish an empirical claim, the gold standard is a well-designed experiment. The key, however, is that qualifier, well-designed. Many of the claims that come our way, claims in the media regarding medical safety or efficacy, for example, are presented as having scientific experiment behind them. In order to really evaluate these claims, we need to be able to evaluate the experimental work behind them. Are those experiments well-designed? Look again at the structure of Feynman's experiment. The question is what caused the disaster. The commission had studied footage of the event repeatedly, and that footage seemed to show a gas blow-by just before the spacecraft broke apart. Could that have been the problem? And what caused that? They were looking for a chain of causal events. A causes B, B causes C, and C causes the disaster. It became clear that a blow-by of pressurized hot gas and flame could have hit an adjacent external tank, leading to the structural failure. But Morton Thiokol insisted that the O-rings couldn't have been what allowed the blow-by. What Feynman's ice water showed was that indeed they could have, that Morton Thiokol was wrong. I want you to note three things about that experiment: the risk of the experiment, its power, and its limitations. First of all, the risk. Karl Popper insisted that every good scientific hypothesis takes a risk of being proven wrong. Feynman took that risk. If the ring had come out of the water and sprung instantly back into shape, his O-ring hypothesis would have been discredited, right there on television. But of course, it didn't come out that way, hence the power of the experiment. It no longer mattered who said that the O-rings couldn't have been the problem. Nature can't be fooled, as Feynman said, and nature said they could have. But note also the limitations of the experiment. All that was shown is that the O-rings could have failed. Perhaps it shows that they could be expected to fail under the temperatures of the flight, 15 degrees colder than any previous launch, incidentally. But the experiment didn't show that something else might not also have been a factor, even a major factor. The experiment only addressed one link in the causal story that the Rogers Commission finally settled on, the link from the O-rings to blow-by. The rest of the story about released gases and flame hot enough to impact the exterior tank, about that leading to the breakup of the spacecraft, all that part of the story had to come from somewhere else. Feynman's experiment, like all experiments, functioned only against a broader theoretical background, within a wider theoretical context. All experimentation is about an if-then. What any experiment really shows is if this, then that. Feynman's experiment shows that if you put a C-clamped O-ring of this material in ice water, then its resilience fails. If X, then Y. It seems to me that humans must have always tested things by asking, what happens if you do this? If you hit a tasty bone with a large rock, or extend a spear with a throwing extension. In that sense, it seems that humans must always have performed experiments. Animals seem to test things in much the same way. They feign an attack to see if the enemy retreats. What'll he do if I do this? They nose prey to see if it'll move again. Scientific experimentation is just a more formal extension of that kind of if-then testing applied to general claims at the level of scientific theories. The question, what was the first scientific experiment, is thus bound to invite controversy. Around 200 BC, Archimedes submerged himself in his bath and saw the displacement of water, then applied that principle to other cases. Does that count as an experiment? Around 50 AD, Hero of Alexandria developed some amazing hydraulic devices, which must have required extensive if-then testing. Does that count as experiment? Credit for the beginnings of scientific experimentation is often given to the Islamic school, the school of Jabir ibn Hayyan, around 800 AD, known for elaborate alchemical equipment and insistence on practical experience, or Alhazen, who around 1000 AD published a work on optics with a number of experimental demonstrations. I think if-then testing is quite natural to both people and animals. Scientific experimentation is just a formalization in a context of large-scale theory. If so, and as long as formalization and large-scale theory remain vague, the answer to what was the first scientific experiment will be vague as well. The concept of controlled experiment leaves a clear historical record. We envisage the functioning of the universe as a complicated pattern of causal chains. We want to know what that causal pattern is. What causes what? We want to know whether X's cause Y's. In order to establish that X causes Y, we have to establish more than just if X, then Y. In order to establish that X causes Y, we really have to establish two if-thens. We need to know that if X, then Y, but we also need to know that if not X, then not Y. We need to know that X is what makes the difference as to whether or not Y happens. The core of any test of causality is therefore a double test. We need to have two cases side by side, one with and one without X. That's the whole idea of a control and of controlled experiment. Here's another beautiful experiment as an example. The theory of spontaneous generation had the authority of Aristotle, who claimed that some animals developed not from kindred stock, but from putrefying matter. It was the decaying meat itself that was thought to generate maggots, for example, which then develop into flies. Imagine yourself in an Italian city in the 1600s. You can imagine the crowded streets, the tiny butcher shops, and the clouds of flies around those butcher shops. Put a piece of raw meat out and it'll soon have maggots. Aha! Spontaneous generation. There's an if-then for you. Francesco Redi had a suspicion that Aristotle was wrong, that all animals developed from kindred stock, and that it was flies rather than meat that generated maggots. In 1687, he published the results of a controlled experiment as a demonstration. He put fresh meat in 4 jars, exposed to flies in the open air. That's the if X, then Y part. If flies, then maggots. But he also put fresh meat in 4 other jars, covered with cloth so as to keep the flies away. That's the if not X, then not Y part. That's the control. Maggots developed in the uncovered jars, but not in the covered ones. It wasn't the meat, but the flies that bred maggots. The double if-thens of controlled experiments form the basis of all our causal knowledge. In constructing an experiment, you have to make sure that you have a clear conception of both the experimental condition and the control. In evaluating an experiment, you need to ask, what's the control? But take a minute to think about what that demands. What we want is 2 cases that are exactly alike, except for the presence of X. If in one of those cases we observe Y and in the other we don't, and the 2 cases are otherwise exactly alike, in that setup it must be X that made the difference. The double if-thens form the basis of all our causal knowledge. The demand that our 2 conditions be identical except for X is the major source of all experimental difficulty. The problem is that there's always the possibility of hidden differences between our 2 conditions. Rady's covered and uncovered jars were supposed to differ only in the presence and absence of flies, but of course they didn't. Air circulation would be different with and without a cloth over the top. Temperature was probably affected. Maybe the type of cloth they used suppressed spontaneous generation. Asking for just 1 difference between 2 cases may be asking for the impossible. Any 2 cases will differ in hundreds of ways. One jar will be north of another, or east, or closer to the window, or the one I put the meat in first. We think we know that those are differences that don't make a difference. But that's just the point. All experiment tests things we don't know against a background of other things we think we do know. The conditions of controlled experiment are no different. The difficulties of getting 2 cases otherwise identical, except for some factor X, becomes even more pressing when we're dealing with complex experimental subjects. People, for example. We want to know whether a given treatment prevents scurvy or cures cancer. We need 2 groups of people, those who are given the treatment and those who are not, but we want the treatment or the lack of it to be the only difference. We want the groups to be identical in all other respects. Good luck. People are complicated. Groups of people are still more complicated. You will never get 2 groups of people identical except for factor X. So what do? Here's another beautiful experiment. Scurvy had long been a problem for men at sea. It was a problem in 1747 when James Lind served as a surgeon on Her Majesty's ship Salisbury. There were a number of proposed cures for scurvy, and he tested them with a controlled experiment. The cures, a quart of cider every day, 25 drops of sulfuric acid in water 3 times a day, or 1/2 pint of seawater every day, a lump of garlic, mustard, and horseradish, 2 spoonfuls of vinegar 3 times a day, 2 oranges and 1 lemon every day. Lynn selected 12 men from the ship, all suffering from scurvy, and as similar as he could choose them, he said. He then divided the men randomly into 6 pairs, giving each pair 1 of the cures, and he watched what happened. The important point is that Lynn chose men as similar as he could and that he randomized them into pairs. As it turned out, all the men showed some improvement. But the 2 given oranges and lemons recovered dramatically. One was back to duty after 6 days. The other helped care for the rest. Lynn's is an early case of what we now call a randomized controlled trial. When it comes to experimental subjects as complicated and as various as people, we can never be confident that the factor X we are testing for is the only difference at issue. Indeed, we know that it won't be. There will always be other differences between people and between groups of people. What we do instead is to assign our groups randomly, with large enough groups, with tests repeated often enough, with strong enough results on one side and not the other, it becomes increasingly implausible that there is some hidden factor other than X that's producing the result. In constructing a solid experiment with complex subjects like people, you want to make sure you have a random enough selection procedure within a large enough group that your results are unlikely to have happened just by chance. You want to know precisely those same things in evaluating experimental claims from other sources, claims from the media, for example. Unfortunately, those crucial details often don't fit within a soundbite. In order to evaluate those claims, you often have to do a little more research as to how the research was conducted. The philosophical understanding of scientific procedure developed hand in hand with its application. I'll give you three high points: the work of Francis Bacon, John Stuart Mill, and R.A. Fisher. In 1620, about 60 years before Rady's experiments refuting Aristotle, Francis Bacon published his Novum Organum, that means the new organon. The title's a direct reference to Aristotle's logic in the Organon. Francis Bacon intended his work to be a new organon, a new philosopher's toolkit. The core of that new organon is an emphasis on if-then experimentation. Bacon contrasts experimentation with other ways, what he takes to be erroneous or fallacious ways of forming beliefs. He pits empirical experiment against appeal to authority, against vague theorizing, against appeals to experience without experimental manipulation. In 1843, the philosopher John Stuart Mill published his System of Logic, intended to offer a logic appropriate to scientific investigation. Mill gave a series of methods, all of which focus on the kind of double if-then test we've emphasized for deciding whether X causes Y. Mill's method of difference is precisely that double test. If X is the only difference between two cases, with Y as a result in one and not in the other, we have an indication that X causes Y. Mill's other methods complement that structure. Here's his method of agreement. If two cases are alike only in X, and Y occurs in both, we again have evidence that X and Y are causally linked. Our evidence is even stronger, of course, if we have both of these. That's Mill's joint method of agreement and difference. Y appears whenever you have X and disappears when you don't. We've talked throughout as if X and Y were just on or off, there or not. Mill also generalizes that to a case in which things might be more or less X or Y. That's the method of concomitant variation. If Y varies as X varies, we again have indication of a causal link. Beyond Mill, the most important improvements in our understanding of scientific procedure have been in the development of statistical measures for randomized testing. The philosopher Charles Sanders Peirce was important in early development. But much of current practice traces back to the English biologist R.A. Fisher. It's been said that Fisher almost single-handedly created the foundations for modern statistical science. Fisher's work was motivated by a beautiful experiment of his own, known as the Lady Tasting Tea example. The topic's trivial. Fisher's experimental design and analysis are not. The British take their tea with milk. At a summer tea party, a lady claimed the tea tasted differently if one first put in the milk and then added the tea, or first put in the tea and then added the milk. Preposterous, said the scientifically minded men around her. Fisher put the question to the test with a randomized control experiment. Four cups were prepared with the milk first. Four cups were prepared with the milk second. The lady was fully informed of the procedure and was then given the cups in a random order. Her task: to pick the four that were prepared with the milk first. Fisher formalized the case in terms of two hypotheses. He actually thought the lady wouldn't be able to detect any difference. He called that the null hypothesis. The alternative hypothesis was that she could tell the difference. If she picked the four cups correctly, what confidence should we put in that alternative hypothesis? Fisher's calculation of what we now call statistical significance was based on the probability that she would have made the right choice by chance alone. That's essentially what all controlled randomized experimentation looks like today, from political polling to medical experimentation. Oh, and the result? She picked the four cups correctly. We can say with a high degree of confidence that there really is a difference in how tea tastes, depending on whether you put in the milk first or second. A difference, at least, in how it tastes to a lady. Complex experimental subjects, like people, make randomized testing a necessity. There are also other ways in which people make things complicated. These call for other constraints in experimental design. Suppose you want to know whether Coke or Pepsi tastes better. You do a straightforward test. You buy a can of Coke and a can of Pepsi and offer people a sample from each. Which tastes better? You can see the problem with that experiment. Coke drinkers may be loyal to their Coke, the same for Pepsi people. Because they can see where each sample is coming from, you may not be getting a pure taste test. In order to make that experiment better, you'd like your test tasters to be unable to see the cola cans. You want them to be blind. Now we're talking about a blinded experiment. There are cases, however, that call for an even more scrupulous experimental design. We've been talking about experiments that involve human subjects. All of those experiments also involve human experimenters. When a researcher strongly believes in a hypothesis, there's always the chance that he or she will influence the results by giving unconscious clues to the experimental subjects. In order to guard against that, double-blind experiments are used. In a double-blind experiment, neither the investigator nor the subject knows until later whether the randomized case they are dealing with is from the if-X group or the if-not-X group. In evaluating experimental evidence, then, you want to know, what was the control? If complex subjects like people are involved, you want to know, how was randomness assured? What's the probability of that result just by chance? For some questions, you may want to know, was this experiment blinded? Or was it double-blinded? Is there a scientific method? In a sense, there surely is. The principles of experimental design we've been talking about are all parts of the toolkit of empirical investigation. The scientific method taught to many a junior high school student includes aspects of investigation emphasized since Francis Bacon. Define a question. Formulate an explicit hypothesis. Design a test with measurable outcome. Perform the test and analyze the results. But the notion of a scientific method that can be followed robotically, like a recipe for truth, is a myth. Alhazen said it in his experimental work on optics. Finding the truth is difficult, and the road to it is rough. William Woole's philosophy of the inductive sciences, published just before John Stuart Mill's system of logic, emphasized that science requires not mere method, but invention, sagacity, genius. Scientific research also often requires luck. It's been estimated that half of all scientific discoveries have been stumbled on. Often the process starts with what appears to be a problem with the scientific apparatus, a bug in the program. When that bug doesn't go away, it starts to dawn on the investigator that the unexpected result may not be an error, but precisely that, an unexpected result. Aha! Here's a beautiful example. On the morning of September 28, 1928, Alexander Fleming came back from vacation to his lab in the basement of St. Mary's Hospital in London. As he tells the story, he noticed a petri dish containing the bacterium Staphylococcus. He'd left it open by mistake, and it was now contaminated by a blue-green mold. Around the mold was a halo in the bacteria. Fleming concluded that the mold was releasing a substance that inhibited bacterial growth. He had discovered antibiotics. After a few months of calling the active substance mold juice, He decided to name it after the blue-green Penicillium mold. He called it penicillin. And as he often had to remind people, I didn't invent penicillin, nature did that. I only discovered it by accident. Much of scientific discovery is a matter not of method, but of invention, sagacity, genius, and luck. All of those can go together. Louis Pasteur is credited with the saying that chance favors the prepared mind. Philosophers of science have long distinguished between a context of discovery and a context of justification. Scientific discovery can be chancy. There's no recipe, no algorithm, no scientific method of discovery. Once a discovery is made, however, the process of demonstrating the fact to others can follow a very specific method, the method of repeatable experiment. Once Fleming had his initial hunch, however fortuitous, it was by controlled experiment that he demonstrated its truth. I've tried to emphasize aspects of experimental design that are important both in presenting and in evaluating experimental evidence. But there are limitations. Unfortunately, there are cases in which the information we need in order to evaluate experimental evidence is somehow hidden or unavailable. Experimental results can be faked, and sometimes have been, both in the fringes of pseudoscience and in core areas of medical testing. Experimental results can be selectively chosen to support the favored case. It's called cherry-picking. There are perennial worries that drug companies choose to report those experiments that make their products look good and choose not to report those that don't. What you really need to know is the results of all the relevant experiments. The file drawer problem. Not every experimental result is submitted for publication, and not every result submitted for publication is accepted. When one surveys the literature searching for whether most experiments support or fail to support a particular effect, one may be surveying a misrepresentative sampling of the tests that have actually been run. The tests that show a less dramatic or a less popular result may be buried unseen in someone's file drawer. There's another limitation to experimentation that I've tried to emphasize throughout. Experiment is never pure. It's always in context. All effective experimentation tests one belief against a background of other beliefs. For the moment, at least, those other beliefs are simply assumed. One of the earliest cases cited in the history of experimentation is Eratosthenes' calculation of the circumference of the Earth, sometime around 225 BC. The basic observation was this. On June 21st, the summer solstice, in the Egyptian town of Syene, the sun appeared directly overhead. Looking down a well, a man's head would block the sun's reflection. Back in Alexandria, Eratosthenes knew that on that day, the elevation of the sun was 1/50th of a circle off from being directly overhead, a little over 7 degrees. He knew that Syene was south of Alexandria, and thanks to the royal surveyors, he knew the distance between the two towns. Assuming the Earth to be a sphere, and the sun to be so far away that its rays could be thought of as essentially parallel, Eratosthenes was able to use those two facts with a little mathematics to conclude that the circumference of the Earth was a little over 25,000 miles, very close to our contemporary estimate. But note the assumptions at issue. If the Earth were not a sphere, the calculation wouldn't hold. The experiment wouldn't show what it was taken to show. If the sun were not so far away that its rays could be treated as parallel, the calculation wouldn't hold. The Huainanzi is a Chinese text from approximately the same date. It also notes that vertical sticks at different points north and south cast shadows of different length on the same day. From that fact, and the assumption that the Earth is flat, the text concludes that the vertical sticks with shorter shadows are directly under the sun, those with longer shadows are farther away, the sun's rays hit those at an angle. From the length of those shadows, the Huainanzi concludes we should be able to calculate the height of the sun. Because no experimental result is established independently of a set of background assumptions, what every experiment really establishes is an alternative, Either the claimed result holds, or one or more of our background assumptions is wrong. In the next lecture, I want to return to a theme that we've touched on at various points: thinking rationally in a social context. In a previous lecture, we talked about decision theory. In a nutshell, when choosing between two options, calculate the probability and the value of possible outcomes. Then pick that option that has the highest probability times value. Maximize expected utility. Decision theory, however, is really made for contexts in which there's just one decision maker, you. There you are, standing at the fork in the road. In that picture, the road taken and the outcome which eventuates are treated as if it was all about you. Most real-life decisions are not all about you. What happens may depend not only on what you decide to do, but on what you, Bill, Mike, the guy next door, Apple, IBM, and Microsoft all decide what decide to do. Where decision theory leaves off, game theory begins. It's designed to address, in an abstract way, rational decision in the social context, the context in which multiple players are making interlocking decisions. An understanding of game theory and an appreciation of its limitations should both be part of the philosopher's toolkit. Let me start with some history. Game theory goes back to John von Neumann, my candidate for the smartest man of the 20th century. Von Neumann was instrumental in the development of computers, the atomic and hydrogen bombs, and game theory. Along with Einstein, he was one of the first professors appointed to the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. The standard configuration used in today's computers is still called the von Neumann architecture. He played a major role in the Manhattan Project. He was responsible for the sphere implosion design used in the first atomic explosion at Trinity, New Mexico, and in Fat Man, the bomb dropped at Nagasaki. After the war, many of those involved wanted nothing to do with that kind of work again. Not von Neumann. He was even more instrumental in the development and testing of the hydrogen bomb. There are photographs of von Neumann at Ground Zero at the Bikini Atoll within a few months of the blast. It's still debated whether radiation exposure contributed to the cancer that killed him at the age of 54. What does his involvement with nuclear weapons have to do with game theory? A lot. It wasn't long after World War II that the Soviet Union had nuclear capabilities too. How do you conduct war? How do you negotiate your way out of it in a world in which both sides have that kind of killing capacity? You can't navigate that world as if you're the only decision maker who matters. You have to think through chains of action and response. If we do this, and they do this, and we respond like this, multiple decisions on both sides are going to matter, and are going to matter a lot. With the possibility of mutual annihilation looming, the stakes could hardly be higher. It was in anticipating a world with two nuclear superpowers that von Neumann developed game theory. The year was 1944. The book was von Neumann and Morgenstern, Theory of Games and Economic Behavior. The title sounds innocent enough, how amusing, games. But the real target was rational strategies for conducting a Cold War rather than a hot one. Games, in von Neumann's sense, aren't just checkers and chess. They include every situation involving cooperation and competition in which the outcome depends on the multiple actions of multiple players. There's one game, one situation regarding cooperation and competition that has become the central exhibit of game theory. You may know it. It's called the Prisoner's Dilemma. The story behind the game is the story of two bank robbers, caught and held in separate cells. Call them Al and Bruiser. You're Al. The DA comes in and says, "Look, I've got to admit our evidence is pretty thin. If you guys both stonewall, you'll get off pretty light. But if Bruiser confesses Al and you don't, we'll use his evidence against you. We'll let him walk and put you away for years. The same thing goes the other way around. If you confess and Bruiser doesn't, we'll let you walk. We'll nail Bruiser instead. And if you both confess, I have to admit we'd love that. You'd both do some time, all right, but with a little discount for the guilty plea. The question is, do you rat on your accomplice or not? The important point is that the outcome doesn't all depend on you. It depends on how the decisions by both prisoners play out. That's game theory. As in previous lectures, we could use a matrix to represent possible outcomes. I'll build it using positive values rather than negative. We'll talk about a maximum of 5 positive points. Those would be the number of years of freedom out of the next 5. Al is player A. Bruiser is player B. If you're player A, you have 2 options. You can defect against Bruiser by turning state's evidence, or you can cooperate with Bruiser by stonewalling. We'll call your 2 options defect and cooperate. Note that cooperate means to cooperate with your partner in crime, not with the police. B has the same 2 options, just like in the story. There are 4 ways this could come out, reflected in the 4 quadrants of our matrix. Both players cooperate with each other, both defect against each other, A cooperates and B defects, or A defects and B cooperates. We'll lay those out in this matrix with a box for each possibility. Payoffs for A are listed in red in each box. Those for B are listed in blue. Game theory is about how decisions interact. What the matrix shows is potential gains and losses for each side given different combined decisions. If one player plays nice by cooperating with the other player, and the other stiffs him by defecting against him, the defector walks away with 5 points, a full 5 years of freedom, say. The cooperator gets no years of freedom. You can see that in the upper right and lower left quadrants of the matrix. If both players choose to cooperate with each other, both end up with 3 points, 3 years of freedom. Pretty good. If both defect, they both end up with only 1 year of freedom. Not so good. So I put it to you, player A, should you cooperate with B or defect against him? What's the rational thing to do in the prisoner's dilemma? Press pause, think about it a minute, and then come back. So what are you going to do? Stay true and cooperate with your pal or defect against him? If you said cooperate, you're an incredibly nice person. But the rational thing to do is to defect. This is a first major result in game theory. Look at it this way. You have no control over what the other guy does. But no matter what the other player does, you're better off defecting. Suppose the other player cooperates. If you cooperate, you get 3 points. If you defect, you get 5. So if he cooperates, you're better off defecting. Suppose the other player defects. If you cooperate, you get 0 points. If you defect, you at least get 1. So you're better off defecting in that case, too. So no matter what the other player does, you're better off defecting. That's what it means for a strategy to be strongly dominant. In a one-shot prisoner's dilemma, defection is strongly dominant. In real life, however, interactions are almost never a one-shot deal. Social life involves repeated interactions with the same people and the same organizations. Your relationship with your baker, your banker, or your partner in crime is almost never a one-shot deal. The parties to the transaction expect to interact again. That's going to make a difference in what behavior is rational. You and I will interact again, and how I treat you next time may depend on how you treated me this time. When we step up to this level, we're dealing with what's called an iterated game. In an iterated prisoner's dilemma, the payoffs on each round stay the same, but there isn't just one round. A and B play once, get their payoffs, and then play again. But of course, they remember what happened last time. Suppose you know that you and Bruiser will keep playing an iterated game. Suppose he burns you this time. You cooperated, but he defected against you. He walked away with 5 points. You ended up with 0. How is that going to affect your future play? In an iterated game, we're talking about the rationality not just of a single cooperator defect, but of strategies of cooperation and defection over time. A really simple strategy might be always cooperate. Simple, but probably not very rational. On the opposite end is always defect. But there are lots of more complex possibilities. There's one strategy that's of particular interest. It's called tit-for-tat. I'll start off cooperating, but whatever you do to me on a given round, I'll give back to you the next time. If you cooperate, I'll cooperate on the next round. If you defect on me, I'll defect on you next time. We know what it's rational to do in a one-shot prisoner's dilemma, defect. But in an iterated game, we're dealing with patterns of play on both sides. You might be playing against people with very different strategies on the other side. You might not know what their strategy is. What's the most rational strategy for you to play? Robert Axelrod is a political scientist at the University of Michigan. In 1980, he tried to get a handle on that question by running a computer-based prisoner's dilemma tournament. Anyone who wanted to was invited to submit a strategy. Submissions came in from game theorists in economics, psychology, sociology, political science, and mathematics. No philosophers, unfortunately. He set it up so that every submitted strategy played 200 rounds against every other strategy. Strategy 1 played 200 iterated rounds against strategy 2, then 200 iterated rounds against strategy 3, and so forth. He also made sure that every strategy played against itself, and also against an opponent that cooperated and defected at random. Axelrod added up the total points that each strategy gained in all those competitions. The winner was the strategy that got the most points overall. Some of the strategies submitted were very complicated. Strategies that kept track of the opponent's play, looking for weaknesses. Strategies that tested and probed the opponent's play, forming hypotheses regarding future action. What strategy would you suggest for Axelrod's tournament? When the dust cleared, there was a clear winner. The strategy that came out with the most points, the most rational strategy to play against that whole field of competitors, was tit-for-tat. Axelrod was flabbergasted. All those complicated submissions, and the one that did the best was one of the very simplest, tit-for-tat. Start off cooperating. If the other guy cooperates, do the same for him next time. If the other guy defects, do the same to him next time. What was even more surprising was the result of a second tournament. The winner of the first competition was announced. People were invited to submit strategies again. Clearly, tit-for-tat was the strategy to gun for. So, lots more complicated strategies designed this time to exploit weaknesses and to stump tit-for-tat. All strategies are pitted against all others in 200 iterated rounds. The winner is that strategy with the most points overall. The winner that second time? Tit for tat. Here's what's particularly amazing about all this. Tit for tat doesn't win because it smashes so many opponents. In fact, tit for tat never smashes an opponent. It never gets more points than the opposition. Tit-for-tat just mirrors the other guy's play, and the best it can do is as good as the other guy's play. So why did tit-for-tat win? Because it did better against the whole field of opponents than any other strategy did. It was particularly important that tit-for-tat did well against other cooperative strategies. In that case, both sides ended up cooperating, racking up 3 points every time. All those competitive strategies designed to exploit an opponent's weakness and the one that does the best overall is a strategy of reciprocal cooperation. In the one-shot prisoner's dilemma, defect is the rational choice. But in repeated games played with lots of different players, like in Axelrod's tournament, and more like real life, the strategy that does best is one that starts by cooperating and returns like for like. That lesson from game theory sounds a little like a relative of the golden rule, doesn't it? It says that the rational thing is to do unto your neighbor as he does unto you. The golden rule says that the ethical thing is to do unto your neighbor as you would have him do unto you. There's a lesson from the tit-for-tat result. Cooperation may triumph even where one might have thought it wasn't possible. That's important. The limitations of game theory also have lessons to teach. Let me turn to those limitations and what they have to teach us about social rationality. I want to give game theory its due, but also look beyond it. The prisoner's dilemma is clearly an artificial setup, artificial enough to be captured in a matrix. That in itself isn't bad. Simplification is one of our most important conceptual tools. But there are several artificialities in that setup of which we should be particularly wary. First, note that everybody knows the rules, everybody knows the payoffs, and it's always clear to both sides whether an action was a cooperation or a defection. That's what's called a game of perfect information. Real life is often not like that. You don't always know the payoffs. In real life, your attempts at cooperation might be read as defections instead. Real life is certainly not a game of perfect information. Second, note that all moves are either full cooperation or full defection. There's no halfway here. What happens if an action can be somewhat but not fully cooperative? I've actually done some research along those lines, and the simple answer is, things get messier fast. More like real life. Finally, note that players have to play on each round. They can't just opt out. I'm just not going to deal with you anymore. People have also investigated formal games in which opting out is a possibility. The result? You guessed it, lots more complex. Just like real life. For real social rationality, then, it's not enough to act as one would in game theory. For real social rationality, one also has to keep in mind that actions of cooperation and competition don't have to be all or nothing, may not always be clear, and that opting out of certain relationships may be an important possibility. Here's another limitation of the work I've outlined. All of the results we've been talking about are results in a particular game, the prisoner's dilemma. That particular game, that particular trade-off between potential competitors or cooperators has been the most studied game in game theory. Why? When you look through the literature, it turns out that no one has a very good answer. The game is fascinating. It does seem to capture something about individual gains versus social benefits. But there's no reason to believe that the prisoner's dilemma is the only game we play. The matrix values define the game. It's a prisoner's dilemma if the value of defecting against a cooperator is greater than the value of mutual cooperation, if that's greater than the value of joint defection, and if the real loser is cooperation in the face of defection. But nothing says that payoffs in all our everyday interactions line up like that. There are other named games with other relative values. Chicken is a game that functions like two teenage boys driving hot rods toward each other. The guy who pulls out first loses. He's the chicken, and everybody makes fun of him. But he doesn't lose as badly as both boys do if neither pulls off. The matrix values for chicken look different from those for the prisoner's dilemma. Stag Hunt is named after a game that appears in the work of the philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau, writing in the 1700s. Rousseau tells the story of two men hunting, each of whom can choose to cooperatively hunt stag or to go for an easier rabbit when one runs by. The big payoff here is for cooperative stag hunting. Anyone who goes for the rabbit can count on a much smaller payoff. The big loser is the man who's still hunting stag while his companion is gone for a rabbit. The matrix for stag hunt is different from both chicken and the prisoner's dilemma. The truth is that we have no reason to believe that any single game captures the balance of payoffs in all our different kinds of interactions. In different contexts, with different people, with different aims in view, we engage in very different games. Payoffs, relative gains, and the possibility of opting out differ across those different contexts. And of course, there are interactions where it's not just decisions of two players that are important, but three players, or four, or more. The wonderful thing about game theory is that it deals with a very real issue of rationality. How to deal with contexts in which the action of not one, but multiple players determine the result. The not-so-wonderful aspect is that it doesn't deal with that very real issue in a very real way. At least not yet. The research continues. Decision theory and game theory have one core characteristic in common. Both gauge rationality in terms of self-interest. In game theory, one's calculating how to maximize one's own gain on the assumption that the other players are doing the same. That's going to be applicable to real-life situations, however, only to the extent that people really act that way. Do they? Do people actually make decisions in the way that game theorists and economists in general regard as rational? The answer is that they don't. That's a major finding of the developing field of behavioral economics, which puts the standard assumptions to the test. The truth is that people systematically violate the economists' canonical assumptions of rationality. They violate them in a variety of different ways. There is a simpler game that's used in many of these studies. It's called the ultimatum game. You and another person meeting for just one time have to split an amount of money, equivalent to a couple days' wages, perhaps. One person is randomly chosen as the proposer. The other person is the responder. Here's the interaction. The proposer gets to propose how the money is to be split. 50-50, perhaps, or 90% to him and 10% to the responder. The responder then gets to choose whether to accept that division or not. If he accepts, the money gets divided as the proposer proposed, 50-50 or 90-10 or whatever. But if the responder declines the division, neither side gets any money at all. So think about that for a minute. Put yourself in the place of the proposer. You've got $300 to divide. What would you propose? Now put yourself in the place of the responder. Suppose the proposer suggests that he gets $270 and you get $30. Would you accept that $30, or would you tell him to shove it, with the result that you both walk away with nothing? Okay, we know what you would do. Here's what economic rationality says that you should do. If you're the responder, you should take any division that gives you any money at all. Why? Because something is better than nothing. If he proposes $30 for you and $270 for him, you should take it. Better something than nothing. Indeed, if he proposes 30 cents for you and $299.70 for him, you should take it. Better something than nothing. What's the rational thing to do as proposer? If the other person is rational in the way just outlined, and you're just out for the money, you should propose as much as possible for you and as little as possible for him. Because he's rational, he'll take it. Because you're rational, you'll walk away with a bundle. Homo economicus is the name that has been given to agents who act as the economic game theorist says they should. One of the primary articles on the issue is titled In Search of Homo Economicus. Is there such a species? Evidently not. In industrialized societies, proposers tend to offer something like a 44% cut to the other side, not close to zero, as Homo Economicus would. Sampling across a whole range of societies across all continents, virtually no proposer offers less than 25% to the other side. But the variability by culture is immense. The Torgud people of Mongolia and the Mapuche of Chile offer about 35% to the other side. The Achuar of Ecuador and the Sangu of Tanzania offer 40% to the other side. The Ache of Paraguay offer an average of 51%. My favorite are the Lamalera of Indonesia. Their proposers offer a full 58% to the other side. We have to split the money? Okay, you take more. Anthropologists and economists have tried to figure out what it is that explains those variations. The answer seems to be the different cultural patterns of everyday life. The more cooperative work is involved in a culture, like the whale-hunting Lamalara of Indonesia, the higher the offer to the other side in this artificial game. It's also true that the more a culture incorporates a market economy, the higher the offer to the other side. What of rejections? In industrialized societies, offers of less than 20% tend to be rejected. In other cultures, almost no offers rejected. But the Ao and the Ganau of Papua New Guinea reject both high and low offers. They will reject offers they think are unfair, even if it's unfair to their benefit. Offer an Ao 58% and he'd rather you both walked away with nothing. What I've tried to emphasize in this lecture is social rationality. As of now, the best formal tool we have for that is game theory. It at least recognizes the issue that decisions made jointly may have a different rationality than those made individually. Game theory supplies some simple models. It even offers some hope for emergence of cooperation in egoistic situations like the prisoner's dilemma. Its limitations, when applied to real life, carry lessons as well. It may not always be clear whether our real life moves are cooperations, defections, or something in between. The game we're playing in real life, the payoffs to each side, may be far from obvious. Indeed, the game itself may be open to negotiation. The motivations of the multiple players won't be as predictable as purely rational models might lead us to believe, and might well depend on differences in cultural background. I want to close with another aspect of social rationality that goes significantly beyond game theory. In order to make decisions rationally, even individual decisions, the first requirement is information. Often it's social means that make that information available. Wikipedia is a testament to social interaction as a source of information. It's also a testament to the unselfish motivations of thousands of anonymous volunteers, unselfish in a way that seems to defy the assumptions of game theory. It's still true, however, that you should check and double-check information that comes from that kind of source. We talked about the wisdom of crowds in an earlier lecture, which is also a way of reading information off social sources. Here's another. The previous lecture began with Richard Feynman and the Challenger disaster. Let me end here with that same case, but with a different message. There it was Feynman's experiment that was the focus. Here, I want to put the emphasis on information that can be read off social action. In the Challenger case, there were four major contractors who manufactured components that might have been at fault: Rockwell International, Boeing, Martin Marietta, and Martin Thiokol. When the spacecraft disintegrated, it might have been any one of those that was to blame. The Rogers Commission made their final report 6 months later. Feynman was ahead of the curve. He did his experiment in front of the television cameras just 2 weeks after the incident. But there was information of a social sort that beat even Feynman. When the incident happened, stock in all of those manufacturers took an immediate hit on Wall Street. Stock prices for Rockwell International, Boeing, Martin Marietta, and Martin Thiokol all fell immediately. But by the end of the day's trading, three were starting to recover. One of the four just kept falling. It was Martin Thiokol, the company that made the O-rings. My guess is that there was information out there that indicated Martin Thiokol as the probable source of the problem. That information became apparent in the actions of people who knew. Even if you were entirely ignorant regarding the technology involved then, you might have been able to read off the relevant information from social behavior. You could have beaten even Feynman to the punch by weeks just by watching stock market activity on the day of the